Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors, dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This hour, we're going to look back at the Russian Revolution, a pair of revolutions in Russia in the year 1917, which dismantled the Tsarist autocracy and led to the rise of the Soviet Union. Joining us for the entire hour, Natalie Bayer is with us, Drake University Associate Professor of History in our Des Moines studio. Hello, Natalie.
Hi, thank you for having me on.
Thank you for being with us. A little bit of your background would be important here, too. You were born in Russia.
Born in Russia, educated in Russia, got my undergraduate degree from Moscow State University, specializing in history at the history department, and then I got my PhD here in the United States at Rice University in Houston.
Mm-hmm. Currently teaching at Drake a course on the Russian Revolution.
Yes, a very interesting experience for me, and I'm hoping an interesting experience for my students as well.
I'm sure it is. Did you experience any of the Soviet Union growing up?
Yes. Yes, I did. I'm of that generation that grew up at the very end of the Soviet Union, and the formative years were under the perestroika. So this is very much the context that is dear to my heart. I also grew up in a family with two historians. Both of my parents are historians, and my mom was a specialist in the history of the Communist Party, believe it or not. So as the perestroika was happening, there were those lively conversations at our dinner table between my parents and their colleagues and friends about history and what is happening in general.
Wow, it sounds like we are in the best of hands with you, Natalie, talking about the 100 years anniversary of the Russian Revolution. Before we get to perestroika and Gorbachev and all those things and Putin after that, let's have you set the scene. Let's go back more than 100 years. Tell us about the events, the forces that led up to that pair of revolutions in 1917.
Well, when we're thinking about the Russian Revolution of 1917, most people tend to think about the October Revolution. And this is just one of two, as you absolutely correctly pointed out. There is a first revolution in 1917, the so-called February Revolution, and this is the revolution that ends the monarchy in Russia. This is the revolution in February that brings the abdication of the monarch, Nicholas II, and there is this transitionary period where the power is... Well, it's not quite clear where it is, really, because there is the so-called provisional government led by some of the people associated with the Russian parliament, the Duma. But there is also a parallel structure on the rise, especially in Petrograd. Petrograd was the new name of the city of St. Petersburg. It was renamed in the middle of the First World War into Petrograd. So there is a different type of government on the rise in Petrograd called the Soviet. And so those two parallel structures, they are going against each other, and they are competing for the support and the audience and the people and for the power, of course, in between February into the October. Mm-hmm. And this is the context in which the Bolsheviks are taking power into their own hands.
Talk a little bit about the Romanov family. What was it 3 centuries the Romanov family ruled Tsar Nicholas II, had that reign ended here? And between those two revolutions, in the first early 1917, what, he sort of abdicated and struck a compromise he thought was good for the country?
Yes, he abdicated in early March of 1917. And if you read the document itself, it's a peculiar document. There is a lot of sadness and regret, but there is also a hope that monarchy will continue somehow. He actually names Grand Duke Michael or Mikhail as the next emperor. And then it is up to this person, up to Grand Duke Michael, to decline to accept the throne until the people are allowed to vote through Constituent Assembly for the continuation of either monarchy or establishing a republic. So even with this document, there is no decisiveness in what Nicholas II is doing. He's sort of redirecting responsibility there.
Mm-hmm. Talk about, of course, the other major player, Lenin here, and perhaps even going back, interesting that Lenin's brother was many decades before the October Revolution hanged for plotting to kill Tsar Alexander the Third. Now, this is the grandfather of Nicholas II?
Yes, absolutely. And this is a great testament to the fact that the revolutionary movement in this big entity that we call the Russian Empire, that the revolutionary movement develops well before 1917. Alexander the Second in the late 19th century is killed by one of the radicals and the nationalists. This is the grandfather of Nicholas II. And so there is this rise of revolutionary ideas and movement and support already in the late 19th century, well into the 20th century. There is another revolution that I need to mention, the revolution of 1905, to add to the complexity and the confusion. Leon Trotsky calls the revolution of 1905 a dress rehearsal for the real revolution of 1917. So the spirit is there, the spirit is developing. And one of the ways in which the spirit is developing is through the support of the Marxist groups and the Marxist theory. So there is a Russian language group of Marxists already in the very early of the 20th century. In 1903, they're having this Congress. And in 1903, they decide what kind of strategy they're going to adopt for bringing possibly socialist revolution into the world. And this is when they split into two groups, two rival groups within the Marxist movement, into the Bolsheviks and the Mensheviks. And the Bolsheviks are led by this young rising star of the Russian-speaking Marxist, Vladimir Lenin. This is where the Bolsheviks are coming from. And so again, there is a whole narrative before 1917. The revolution is not coming from nowhere. Mm-hmm. There are real economic and political and social conditions, but there are also ideological foundations and the political forces that are ready to play this game when they have an opportunity in 1917.
Right. So many fascinating aspects leading up to the Russian Revolution. Volumes have been written about it. One other major facet perhaps you can mention here is we, of course, have the start of the First World War in 1914. Mm-hmm. Russia in there from the very beginning, and by the accounts that I've read, performing miserably, right?
Oh, yes. It's not going well for the Russian Empire in the war. And just to give you a taste of how badly it is going, in the beginning of the war, the Minister of War, Sukhomlinov, the person who's supposed to lead the military effort, he's actually accused of treason, and he stands the trial for treason. And so there are different factors that are contributing to the Russian army not performing well, the logistics and the decisions from Nicholas they're not helping.
He assumes supreme command of the Russian army in 1915.
Yes, one of those decisions.
And he's not very good at it.
He is not very good at it. He imagines himself this great military strategist. But what he does, he goes to the headquarters, he goes to the front lines, and he is arguing with his generals, not letting them do their job. But by removing himself from the capital, from Petrograd, it has consequences. He actually leaves his wife, Empress Alexandra, Alex, as he calls her, in charge of the country. And I just have to mention it, that one of the biggest factors in how the people start criticizing the imperial couple is that Empress Alexandra is actually of German origin. And the country is involved in a war with Germany,
right.
And Germans are fighting on the Russian territory now.
And add to the fact also, this is a name that we know well in the West, that there is this mysterious figure, Rasputin.
Absolutely. People are fascinated with this connection that Rasputin and the influence that Rasputin has over...
He's an advisor to the Tsar's family, right? And he allegedly has powers and is alleged to have saved one of the children, the boy.
Yes, the boy. The boy is important in the picture. Nicholas and Alexandra, they really needed and wanted to have a boy, an heir to the throne. And so when the boy is born, finally, through various misfortunes, right, they finally have this boy, and they absolutely adore him. But he has this terrible illness of hemophilia and other complications. So Alexandra especially, she relies on the people who she thinks can help the young Tsarevich, Alexis, to live his life without pain and be as happy as possible. And somehow this mysterious figure of a Russian Orthodox monk, Rasputin, he is able to not just earn the trust and the loyalty of the imperial couple, he is somehow also able to ease the sufferings of this young boy. So he starts as a healer and a friend, but Rasputin soon finds himself deciding political affairs. And Alexandra and Nicholas II, they consult with Rasputin on what kind of ministers, what kind of people they would want to have in the government. And every time they need to make a decision, they go to Rasputin. And so increasingly by the people, Rasputin is seen as this person who's actually leading the country. And and there are terrible things, terrible rumors about the connection between Rasputin and Empress, especially. Mm. And the press is involved very much in all of that.
We could spend an hour talking about Rasputin's connection to the family there, the Tsar's family. But we have to fast forward. Rasputin is murdered. This is another sign that it's not going well for the Tsar's family.
Yes, Rasputin is killed
in a gruesome way.
Oh, yes. The story itself is a terrifying story when I tell it to my students, and they read about it in detail from the people who participated in the affair. It is a terrible thing to do, but people rejoice. Finally, there is no Rasputin in their lives and in the lives of the imperial couple. Yes, so the end of 1916 is one of those turning points. A very difficult winter in terms of the military strategies, in terms of the logistics. It's also bitterly cold.
Right.
It's one of those winters in Russia that is extremely cold.
Okay, so we're up to the winter of 1916 into 1917. 1917, of course, the big year. I want to remind our listeners that we're remembering the Russian Revolution of 1917. Natalie Bayer is with us, Drake University Associate Professor of History, born in Russia, experienced the end of the Soviet Union there. So we have a little less than 10 minutes to get into the year 1917. Take us through that year and this duo, this pair of revolutions.
Mm-hmm. Well, as I said, with the February Revolution, we see the transition for the country from monarchy to republic. And so Theoretically, it is the so-called provisional government led by Georgi Lvov and Alexander Kerensky who decide the matters now. But there is a parallel structure, another power, the Petrograd Soviet, an assembly of workers who start participating in the political processes very actively. So in between February and the summer, there is the struggle for power between the provisional government and the Petrograd Soviet. They have different ideas on what to do with the war. The provisional government makes this decision to continue Russian involvement in the First World War, while the Petrograd Soviet insists on the immediate withdrawal of the country from the war. So war becomes one of those issues.
Mm-hmm.
And the second question that they need to reconcile on, and they're not able to do so, is an extensive land reform, giving land to the peasants. The provisional government insists on the industrialization and having private property on land, while the Petrograd Soviet is thinking about some sort of a land reform that would distribute the land to those who are in need.
Tell us the story. This is really fascinating. This dynamic young leader of the Bolsheviks has been in exile. He returns in the spring of 1917 and arrives in Petrograd in this sort of sealed train with the help of the Germans, I believe.
Yes, and this is the basis for one of those strong conspiracy theories. Lenin, who is abroad at the time of the February Revolution, he needs to get back to Russia. And in order to do so, he needs to cross not just borders, he needs to cross front lines. There is a war that is going on. So supposedly there is some help from the German government providing a sealed train for Lenin and allowing him to go back. Whether it is true or not, whether there is this strong participation of the German government, we know that Lenin did use this train, this opportunity. Yeah. And so he arrives back to Russia in April of 1917, and he arrives with a special program called April Thesis. And in this program, he outlines the strategy for the Bolsheviks to follow in order to possibly take power into their own hands. And a part of this strategy, well, the core of the strategy really, is that the Bolsheviks would refuse to cooperate with the provisional government.
Paralyze it.
Absolutely. And what the Bolsheviks would do for the summer of 1917, they would criticize both the provisional government and the Petrograd Soviet and all of the political rival parties for trying to reach a consensus.
Okay, so paralyzing the government, then criticizing it, and this is the genius of Vladimir Lenin, right?
Yes, and not every Bolshevik is supporting this program in the beginning, but then this is the strategy that makes Bolsheviks look like a radical new power, who are offering something new, who are not going to try and reach compromises, who are going to destroy everything that is hated, everything that is associated with the tradition, and be able to do something that has not been attempted before.
Mm, so fascinating. Natalie, we have about 2 or 3 minutes until we take a break. So to finish up the October Revolution, the Bolsheviks take over Petrograd, right?
Yes.
There is a treaty between Germany and Russia. Mm-hmm. So Russia exits the First World War.
Yes.
And then what we have going on into 1918, The Tsar's family meets a horrible end.
Meets a horrible end. But with the Bolsheviks taking power in October of 1917, taking power in Petrograd, it doesn't mean that the whole country supports the Bolsheviks. Right. And so the revolution continues. And I personally think that the revolution continues with the civil war. The civil war should be a part of the revolution. And so
lasts into the 20s, right?
Yes. And some historians claim that as long as 1922, actually, there are some remnants of the White Army. So it's a long process.
Tell us, help us understand from our vantage point in the 21st century, what was the appeal of the Bolsheviks? Because Lenin reappears. He does capture a lot of power. Mm-hmm. He has a genius in his strategy, too. Mm-hmm. But what were a lot of the people yearning for that made the Bolsheviks look so appealing?
Well, it's what he offers is a very simple, straightforward message without going into the details and the intricacies of the classical Marxist theory. His message is straightforward. The people need peace. The people need bread and land. And the provisional government give you war, hunger, no food, and the land remains with the landowners. And so he's pushing all of the buttons here and appealing to as wide of an audience as possible. And these are the people who are eager to listen to this type of message because this is what they need. They need peace, they need bread, and they're very much interested in the land question, too.
Mm-hmm. Finish up this half hour before we take a break. The final minute here, Lenin survives an assassination attempt, but then he dies. Mm-hmm. How does he die?
Well, again, it's an open space for conspiracy theories. It is a natural death. He suffers a series of strokes, and so 1924 he dies. Again, it opens up a long and difficult period of struggle for power in the young Soviet Union.
Okay, when we come back, we want to talk about pick up the story there with Joseph Lenin, ruling the Soviet Union as its dictator from the mid-1920s. Natalie Bayer is with us, Drake University Associate Professor of History, a native of Russia. When we come back, Bill Reisinger of the University of Iowa will join us as well. Let's go into this break with Sergei Prokofiev's cantata for the 20th anniversary of the October Revolution. This recording, a part of it, by the London Symphony Orchestra. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. Различным образом, объясняли мир философы. Философы,
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors, dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
And we're back midstream in this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. Today, recalling the Russian Revolution about 100 years ago, sort of spread out over 1917, but a lot to do with the revolution before the year 1917, also in the years after, the aftermath of that key year, 1917. So glad to have with us Natalie Bayer, Drake University Associate Professor of History, also someone who experienced the Soviet Union, was born in Russia. She's been walking us through the lead up to the 1917 revolution, its aftermath as well. Let's get to this final key player as we talk about the 20th century. Joseph Stalin, Lenin has died in the mid-20s, but I believe his body is still to be seen, isn't it? I don't know. Have you been to Moscow to see his body?
Well, I've been to Moscow, but I haven't had a chance to see his body. You can if you're there.
Yeah.
It is very well preserved. There is an ongoing debate on what to do with the body. And there were renewed debates about that in coming up to the centennial of the revolution. And there is a strong argument that the body needs to be buried, while others are saying that this is the part of the history that needs to be preserved for the generations to experience it for themselves. So you can still go and visit Comrade Lenin on the Red Square in the mausoleum. It's still open a few days a week, I believe.
Mm. Okay, so Vladimir Lenin dies in the mid-20s. Joseph Stalin rules the Soviet Union as its dictator from the mid-20s until his death in 1953. How did Joseph Stalin take power?
Well, it's a gradual rise to power. He is already operating in a structure that is a very well-organized, strong hierarchical state with a developed bureaucracy. So he takes power gradually, and his first role is the Commissar of Nationalities. He's not ethnically Russian. He's Georgian by birth. And he starts his career by actually writing theoretical pieces about Marxism and the question of nationalities. So this is his thing, Commissar of Nationalities. But he takes on more responsibilities gradually. He becomes Commissar of the Workers' and Peasants' Inspectorate. It might not sound like a very exciting job to you, but it was an important one because he was responsible for the training of the bureaucrats within the state structure. So he controls the question of nationalities. He controls the bureaucrats. Then he becomes a member of the political bureau. This is the top group within the party that decides the ideological question. So he is in the ideology as well. And so the next step is General Secretary of the Party Central Committee. He decides what is being discussed and how it is discussed by the party's Central Committee. So this is a wide scope of responsibilities that allows him to tap into the power structures in this hierarchical bureaucratic state. And then it's a brilliant combination of determination and ideological power struggle. He actually goes against Leon Trotsky first and uses manipulation and alliances with other Soviet leaders and the ideologists. And so in this power struggle with Leon Trotsky, by 1927, this is where Stalin is fully in power already after that.
Okay. Natalie Bayer with us. I want to have Bill Reisinger of the University of Iowa join us as well by phone, professor of political science. Political scientists we have on often in such instances because Bill specializes in Russian politics. Welcome back, Bill.
I'm happy to be here.
Let's have you comment here. When you think about the impact of the Russian Revolution in through the 20th century, what would you point to as the main sort of ripples from that, let's say, 1917 event into the 20th century and perhaps into today?
Quite a few, of course, and quite a few that go beyond the political into the realms of culture and social relations and such. But just to focus on some of the political ramifications of that event, that would include the model that the Soviet Union set up of how you run a country, an authoritarian country, through a single-party system. And that model that the Bolsheviks and then the Communist Party of the Soviet Union kind of pioneered has become much more widespread. And it continues today, not just in places like China, but also in places that are not, where the parties are not communists. So it was kind of an innovation in the forms of authoritarianism that became quite popular throughout the 20th century.
Bill, what are the roots of the West's hostility toward the Soviet Union? In the Second World War, of course, we were allied with Soviet troops in the fight against the Nazis, Nazi Germany. The goal of world revolution, I guess, puts the United States at odds with this country.
Sure. The Bolsheviks and the socialist movement was based on a fundamental critique of capitalism, of Western market economics, and the system of economy and, by extension, the society in countries like those of Western Europe and the United States and others. So basically what the communists were saying is you're going to go into the trash heap of history, and we're going to get rid of you, and we're going to have a worldwide revolution, not just here in Russia. So in that sense, their kind of overt ideological vision of the future was one in which the capitalist countries were threatened.
Mm-hmm. Talk about the early 20th century. When this is happening in Russia, as Natalie described in our first half hour, it's kind of hard to imagine, perhaps for many people from our vantage point, that capitalism could be questioned. But in the 20s and 30s, the United States, other Western democracies were really in doubt, many in doubt, whether capitalism was going to work out at all. Right, Bill?
Yeah, that's right. And the basic Marxist argument about capitalism has a fair amount of truth to it, which is that companies, whether they're corporations or small businesses, they have to make a profit. They have to make a profit by making more money than what they pay to the workers who work for them, and that is going to gradually build up a system of economic inequality and create an upper and lower class if it isn't checked somehow by other things. And what the capitalist countries throughout the 20th century then moved to do was introduce government policies and government regulations and social security kinds of policies that would reduce and mitigate the worst excesses of capitalism while keeping the basic market functions. But prior to that, so here in the United States, this was the New Deal in the 1930s, but prior to that, it looked quite feasible that capitalism could get to a point where it had antagonized most of the people in the society and causing them to be open to revolution.
Mm-hmm. And Natalie, back to you. What about this Marxist goal of a utopian society? There mm-hmm. is no economic inequality, no conflict. Mm-hmm. How long was that an opinion held by the movement, the Bolsheviks, into the communist movement as it sort of morphed into Stalinism mm-hmm. and what happened under Stalin?
Well, the basic idea of radical equality and building socialism and then transitioning to the stage of communism was still a goal going into the 1980s and the dissolution of the Soviet Union. So the rhetoric was still there. There were radical breaks between the rhetoric and the reality, of course. But the basic ideas of Marxism-Leninism were the foundation of the state as it progressed through the decades into the 1990s.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to play a bit of audio here, too, because as we talk about equality and how this system works, how the economy worked under the communist Soviet Union, I want to fast forward to the 1980s, to the very end of the Soviet Union, which you experienced in Russia, Natalie, mm-hmm. and what was happening here, of course, Ronald Reagan saw the end of the Soviet Union in his lifetime and also uttered that famous phrase, tear this wall down, the end of the Cold War. Here is an interesting archival piece of audio from President Reagan in the 1980s. He liked to collect and retell jokes that he said the Soviet Union's citizens tell about their own society. Here is one of them that he told in a speech in 1988 in Virginia.
You know, there's a 10-year delay in the Soviet Union of delivery of an automobile, and only one out of seven families in the Soviet Union own automobiles. There's a 10-year wait. And you go through quite a process when you're ready to buy, and then you put up the money in advance. And this happened to a fella, and this is their story that they tell, this joke, that this man, he laid down his money, and then the fella that was in charge said to him, okay, come back in 10 years and get your car. And he said, morning or afternoon? And the fellow behind the counter said, well, 10 years from now, what difference does it make? And he said, well, the plumber's coming in the morning.
one of Ronald Reagan's jokes that he said he got from the Soviet Union. told in 1988, Natalie Bayer, I have to ask, how close was that to the truth?
Very close. Russians, if you think about the disasters of Russian history for the last 5 centuries or so, humor is the darkest, most extreme kind of humor, but that allows to look at the reality with some laughter there. But what it brings up is a serious ideological difference, though. For the Soviet Union, for the Soviet economy, the emphasis on consumer goods was not the main concern. Consumer goods were associated, and services were associated with the capitalist economy, and the Soviet economy was not about that. It was about the collective state project. So with this particular joke, I think I've heard it in Russian.
You have heard it.
I think I did.
So it is true to fact. Reagan did mine a joke that was told by Russians in the era of the Soviet Union. Let's get up to the current era, more or less. The Soviet Union falls under Gorbachev, and then we have a time before the current leader, Vladimir Putin, takes office and holds, pulls Russia back from its approach to democracy?
Well, he's not really responsible for that, I guess, initially. So some of the failures of democracy and the project of building democracy really are already underway in the 1990s, hastened by the really terrible economic straits that Russians were living through. But he puts together a particular form of authoritarian rule that, you know, over the first 5 or 6 years that he's in power. He is able to create a certain form of new strong state order, returning the country's economy into one where the state plays a large role in some of the big businesses, including the energy sector and things, and clamping down on the media and not allowing rich business people to be involved in politics anymore. So Putin really, really does a lot of things to change the way Russia seemed to be going in the 90s.
Mm-hmm. A couple of big questions from today. Natalie, let me go to you. How do Russian residents view the 100th anniversary of the Russian Revolution today?
Well, people are divided. Revolution is not a fashionable concept in Russia, and talking about Putin and his ideas, what he's putting forward is the idea of order and stability. And so revolution is not one of those concepts with the radical disruption of reality and the tradition that he or the state would support, which brings me back to the idea of the 100th anniversary of 1917 not actually being commemorated on the state level. Not even mentioning celebration. So order and stability are the catchphrase of the current state, and this is the attitude to the revolution in general.
Let me read a little bit by the Washington Post's David Filipov. He's the Post's bureau chief in Moscow in a recent article talking about the current Putin regime and its reaction, its marking of the 100th anniversary. He writes in his article, Putin has frequently touched on the devastating upheaval wrought by the birth of the Soviet Union. In an October speech, he decried its, quote, cost of destroying our statehood and the ruthless fracturing of millions of human lives. At the same time, Putin cannot publicly condemn the Bolshevik Revolution, not when the Communist Party, which will be holding a rally in Moscow, remains one of the two most popular opposition parties in Russia. Comment on that, Bill.
Yeah, well, it's. I think that captures things well from the leadership's point of view. There's this great irony that the government, which has, including President Putin, have done usually a very clever job of merging history and historical looks backward with efforts to change Russia in the present. And yet they are, for the reasons that we heard, they are trying to stay away from this whole idea of revolution. But, you know, even the people in Russia who do want to celebrate the revolution and who organized the marches in the big cities last week, they are, to an interestingly high degree, they're stressing the Stalin period. They're stressing the Great Leap Forward in industrialization and other things, along with all the repression and other stuff. So it's not really the revolutionary moment of 100 years ago that is being celebrated in Russia.
Mm-hmm. We didn't talk about this in connection with Stalinism, Natalie. We had a by and large, a peasant agrarian society turned within a couple of decades, into an industrial society. That was not without a lot of repression and pain under Stalin.
Oh, yes. There is a lot of violence that is involved in the process, and it is the methods that Stalin is mostly associated with. But people in Russia who are evaluating their past from the standpoint of achievement, some of them tend to emphasize that achievement, that rapid economic progress, the level that the Soviet Union was able to reach in a short period of time, rather than individual victims of the regime. So it is a matter of evaluation of history. What do we value more, individual lives or the achievements of the state? And there is a lot of longing and nostalgic looking at the past. And Stalin is coming up in most of the discussions about the revolution, mm-hmm. which is a paradox in itself, right? Given the time period, removing Stalinism from 1917, but also the connections are there clearly.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Let's get to this question from a listener in Fairfield before we go. There, a lot of terms thrown around here. Quickly, what is the difference between a Leninist, a Marxist, a Stalinist, a communist? Is there a quick way to do that, Natalie?
It is a loaded question, and the terms itself. A Marxist is an umbrella term. A Bolshevik would be a particular type of Marxist. A Leninist would be a Bolshevik and a particular type of Marxist. And a Stalinist would be a product of Leninism and Marxism together in regards to methods. So they're all different, and it is difficult to consider them under the same umbrella.
Mm-hmm. Bill, before we end this conversation, any other major facets you want to mention, the legacy of the revolution for Russia today, for the world today?
One important one that just got mentioned is nostalgia. And I think for Russians today, there is a great deal of nostalgia. And I think, as in the United States, it's unproductive. It's looking back to times that really weren't as grand and glorious as they're now remembered to be. So that's a shame. The other thing that stands out is just the extent to which some of the ways of looking at things that citizens developed in the Soviet Union and other communist countries carry forward into the post-communist societies. So relatively low support for free markets, preference for high state involvement in the economy, weak support for democracy and democratic values that still are part of the legacy of the communist period.
Okay, Bill Reisinger, University of Iowa Professor of Political Science, thank you for joining us today.
My pleasure.
And Natalie Bayer in our Des Moines studio, Drake University Associate Professor of History, thank you so much for walking us through the 20th century and telling us about the forces at work in the Russian Revolution 100 years ago. Natalie, it's a pleasure having you on our show.
Thank you. My pleasure.
I want to end the program today with a band called Rabfak. That is name comes from the name of a workers' party in the Soviet Union that prepared workers for higher education. A band, the winner of the contest for best music video, protesting the ruling party, United Russia. That's a song set in a psychiatric hospital. The song is called "Our Loony Bin is Voting for Putin." Let's listen to a few seconds. Some of the lyrics. It's all so complicated, it's so mixed up, but there's no time to figure it out. Oh, brother, our madhouse is voting for Putin. Our madhouse is glad to have Putin.
Из розетки я принял секретный сигнал, говорят, что...
And that brings to the end this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio. Produced by Ben Stanton, Emily Woodbury, and Lindsay Moon. Robbie Broad helped us out as well. The executive producer of Iowa Public Radio's talk shows is Catherine Perkins. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.
Кругом разгильдайства, разбил и раскол. Нет ответа, а на тебе.